Hello everyone and welcome to this live episode of Gutcast, the first podcast for people living with inflammatory bowel disease in Ireland, developed by Crohn's and Colitis Ireland and Johnson & Johnson. I'm delighted to welcome you all here on World IBD Day and to celebrate the 40th anniversary of Crohn's and Colitis Ireland. My name is Amy and I'm the COO of Crohn's and Colitis Ireland, and I've been the host of Gutcast since its launch in 2020, and I myself was diagnosed with Crohn's disease in 2019. Through Gutcast, we aim to create an easily accessible series of content where people can access credible information from healthcare professionals and people with lived experience of IBD. For today's discussion, we will dive deep into the reality of living with IBD and we'll chat with Ciarán Davis and Victoria Spillane about their lived experience. I'm also very delighted to be joined by Angela Mullen, who is an IBD nurse specialist in Cork University Hospital. And would you believe all four of us have actually been part of Crohn's and Colitis board. Ciarán and Victoria are current members and myself and Angela are past members as well, which is quite nice as we celebrate our 40th anniversary. Victoria is joining us via live stream today, as with the reality of living with IBD due to recent surgery, wasn't able to be here with us in the Kingsley Hotel. However, we are delighted to be having her here via the big screen.
Hi, everyone.
Ciarán and Victoria, thank you so much for being here with us today. Ciarán, I suppose if I could start with yourself, you have been a member of Crohn's Colitis Ireland for a few years. We'll talk about that a bit later. But you were diagnosed with IBD over 30 years ago and received emergency care prior to that diagnosis. Could you maybe tell us a bit about your story?
Okay, yeah. So hi, everybody. My story started around 1990. So after school, I spent a year in university and then a job in the bank came up and I started the job. And I was working for about a year, and that was around May time 1990. I just noticed there was something happening and I felt really tired and there was no explanation, and eating better and sleeping better didn't make a difference. And the first really noticeable symptom were mouth ulcers, and that made me go to the GP. And then further into the summer then, into June and July, I was noticing people commenting about that I was very pale, I was losing weight, things that I hadn't noticed. I started vomiting a lot, so I was finding it difficult to hold food down. I was going to the bathroom, so there was the diarrhea as well. So I had to go back to the GP then. I then was referred to a consultant, and it was actually a consultant endocrinologist for some reason rather than a gastroenterologist, but it didn't seem to make any difference. His name was Jim Finucane, a lovely doctor. So he brought me into hospital for a week for the tests, and I did barium studies, some of the more old-fashioned studies, the barium swallow, the barium meal. That's when the latex gloves and the tubes that were being inserted in different places all started, so all that wonderful stuff. So they then actually did a laparotomy, which is surgery, where they actually opened me up to take my intestines out to have a look, took some biopsies, and they diagnosed a thing called Yersinia enterocolitis, which was this weird and wonderful sounding thing, but it was sort of a self, if that's what it had been, that would have had the same symptoms as Crohn's disease. So they said it could be Crohn's or it could be this other thing, but this would have been a self-limiting thing like the flu. You know, we would have gotten over it, would have gotten better, and then that would have been it. In other words, it wasn't a long-term chronic condition like Crohn's or colitis. So they treated me with some very strong, high dose of antibiotics, and that did seem to make a difference. So that seemed to be it. That seemed to be the end of the story. By this stage, I was out sick from work, and I ultimately was out sick for about seven months in total. And I started to get sick again and was just really, you know, having really terrible symptoms like the bathroom, the pain, vomiting, really, really bad night sweats and things like that. And I ended up, as you said, Amy, I ended up then being admitted through A&E to hospital a few months later. And after a few weeks, it was actually a fistula that formed. Some of you will be familiar with those. And that's actually how they diagnosed the Crohn's disease, strangely enough. So I was given the steroids, which a lot of people would be familiar with. And I was very fortunate in the sense that although my flare and subsequent flares caused me to be very sick very quickly, I was actually very lucky in that I responded to medication very, very quickly and I maintained remission. So I didn't have a flare for another 4 years, 5 years actually. And I went back to university and I finished my degree at night and I didn't have any problems with that. So that was my story about that. So why I got involved with CCI was, I suppose, by the time I got involved, I'd been involved in a few support groups. I'd worked in the UK, I'd worked here, I'd been a member of the what was then the ISCC for many years. And I kind of thought, you know, there's more to, you know, managing or living with your health condition than just the engagement you have with wonderful doctors, wonderful nurses, but they do a great job and they really do. And I always had a really good experience with the health system and the healthcare professionals I dealt with. But they're looking after getting you well medically. And there's a lot more to dealing with and living with your health condition than just that engagement with the healthcare professionals, your doctors, your nurses, dietitians, and all these other wonderful people that you come up against. So I just knew that there was more to that. And I suppose I wanted to sort of step through that sort of looking glass, as it were, to see, you know, that side of managing your health condition. And that's really why I got involved.
Yeah, and we're so grateful. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And we'll definitely talk a bit more because we are celebrating the 40th anniversary of the charity. So definitely will be nice to reflect on a few things a little bit later. Victoria, if it can also bring you in as well. And I suppose you were also diagnosed quite young as well. Would you mind sharing your story with us?
Yeah, sure. So I was 13. When everything kind of fully kicked off with me, it was back in 1989. So just a few years after Ciarán, so we're at the kind of 90s babies in a way with the Crohn's diagnosis. Mine started rather kind of unconventional. So I started with a pain in my left knee and then lower back pain. So, you know, the way that you can get the arthritic effects of Crohn, it's side effects from Crohn's disease, that's how it basically manifested within myself. I would always be one of those rare cases. People say I'm a medical mystery. Again, just after my most recent surgeries, just after coming back up again, it's like, right, nothing is ever straightforward. So I was going to my GP and he kept saying, what's a basketball injury? And I was like, okay, fine. But then after a few months, all the other symptoms started to come on pretty heavily. Constant diarrhea up to 20 plus times a day, abdomen pain, just nonstop. I just would never ever ease up. Lack of appetite, weight loss. I was always like an athletic build, but I just went away down to 5 stone, fatigue, everything, you know, mouth ulcers, episcleritis in the eye, the inflammation of the eye, all came on at once. So my parents kept bringing me to the GP. Back then it wasn't as known within society as it is now. So I think that a lot of GPs back then weren't as aware of, you know, such a disease. Mine certainly wasn't. He kept saying, oh, again, as I said, it's a basketball injury. Then he'd ask my parents, was I being bullied? Would I have an eating disorder? And I remember being 13, sitting in the doctor's surgery saying, no, I have none of these things. There is something else wrong. My bloods were obviously done. They were coming back very high inflammation markers. I got to a stage, it was Christmas 1989, where I always remember I sat on the floor after my Christmas exams in secondary school. Went home, sat on the floor. My mom tried to give me a shepherd's pie. And she was like, will you please just try and eat it? I couldn't eat it. I couldn't get the heat into me. I was sitting in front of the fire. And she said, enough is enough. Herself and my dad brought me straight up to the A&E in the CUH. It was there and then I was just admitted. And it was Professor Fergus Shanahan who was called in. I always remember the first words he said was, who let this girl get so sick? The minute that he saw me. So anyone who knows Fergus, which I assume that there's a lot in the room would know, very direct man and an absolute amazing gastroenterologist. And from there, he just knew straight away. So there was a lot of testing that had to go on. The same with Ciarán, you know, where you'd get your Bayley meals, Bayley menemas, colonoscopies. He knew in his head that what it could possibly be. And he did say to my parents, he said, I'm hoping that it's not what I'm thinking. They did other scans. There was a fistula that did show up, but they weren't sure at the time because obviously I was under pediatric doctor as well, Dr. Watson. And they were saying, was it possibly a tumor that was there as well? There was a lot up in the air until all the tests could be done. But what they saw ended up being a fistula. So I had Crohn's disease of the entirety of my large intestine. I was to have surgery there and then to have it fully removed. So I was to get a permanent ileostomy at that point. To be honest, I did not care. All I said was, I just want to be better. And they said, but you'll end up with a bag for life. And I said, I actually don't care. I just want to be better. I was just sick of being sick. I'm a person, I was always very into, you know, knowing about the body, anatomy and all that stuff. So I was plaguing the doctors and the surgeons at the time. It was like, but why? And what's this? And what's that? So I just wanted to know the info. And yeah, I just didn't care, to be honest, if I got the bag there. And then I was so, so sick of being sick. And I just wanted my life back. So I was done for surgery, prepped everything, and they decided last minute to change their course of action. And Fergus Shanahan said that he would try and, because I was so young, he would try and save the intestine for as long as he could. So I was pumped full of IV steroids. And overnight, I went from being 5 stone to my face, just as people would know, completely exploding out, was not ready for that whatsoever. I woke up the next morning thinking I had the mumps again. And I was saying, what has happened to me? Which was a big shocker to even my family to walk into the room the next day. Overnight, I just, my whole body just exploded out. But in saying that, I did get about another 12 years before having to have the surgery. I was put on every drug known to man at the time, all biologics, everything. Unfortunately, I did fail them all. And I got to a stage when I was about 24. I just knew myself. I remember going up to clinic and I said, now's the time. I said, just take it. There was nothing else on the market that was going to work for me. It was a case of, will we kind of try and mix this drug with another drug? And I said, no, I've had, and I would be the person to get the rare side effects from medications as well. And I said, no, I've gotten rare side effects from X, Y, and Z. I'm not going to be putting that with another one right now. Not a hope. So yeah, on the 21st of January, 2011, Guinea was born. That's what I call my bag. Guinea was born, and it was the best thing to have happened because I did have a fistula that went undetected that was leaking. So the surgeon did say another 2 weeks and I probably would not have been on this podcast right now. I would not be around. So I was very lucky to have had the surgery done. And yeah, to be honest, it did save my life at the time. I really did. And I did take to having the bag like a duck to water, as the stoma nurses would say, just because I think in my head, I always knew that the day was going to come that I would need the bag. And I did have a hand in coming across that decision myself, you know, where I was like, look, I'm ready to have it, which does help. And here I am now, 13 years later, having mechanical issues due to having a stoma and Crohn's and everything else. So right now the Crohn's is asleep, but it's snoring, as I say. And yeah, I've just had a recent surgery now around the stoma and more surgery in the future, but not sure when. So it's never ending.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that. I actually really like that sentence you just said, that my Crohn's disease is asleep, but it's snoring, which I think is actually a really important line because, you know, we all, you know, when we live with Crohn's or colitis, there might not be inflammation, but that doesn't mean sometimes we're seeing things like the fatigue or some sort of manifestation, says it. And I think that's a really nice way of actually kind of saying it and reminding ourselves that, you know, if we're seeing something, that can happen. Thank you so much, Victoria, for sharing that story. Angela, if I could pop over to yourself, I suppose I'm always fascinated as to why medical people like gastros and IBD nurses go down the route of inflammatory bowel disease personally, because I always think it's quite an interesting one. Can you tell us maybe about your journey into getting into this space and, you know, what an IBD, for anyone who may not be fully linked into the IBD nurse, you know, what does an IBD nurse do for people living with IBD?
So I suppose my journey started, I was abroad for years and years and years, had a lot of GI experience, gastrointestinal, with doing endoscopies medically and surgically, both working on various different wards. I mean, I've been nursing a long time. I qualified in 93, so I've been around a while. So I suppose then I moved into endoscopy, where you go in and you have a colonoscopy or gastroscopy. I'm sure everybody in the room knows what I'm talking about. And then, you know, you see patients who are struggling. So I suppose I just wanted more. And I suppose a lot of IBD nurses, and, you know, there are about 50 of us, I suppose, in the country. That's how we kind of just developed into the role as such. It's a chronic disease. Chronic disease management is very important, and should be highlighted. For myself then, I was working in Dublin for 13 years. I was working in one of the big hospitals in Dublin as an IBD nurse, and then got an opportunity to come back to Cork. So now I'm in the CUH for the last 2 years.
And then, so what does our IBD nurse do? How is it different to our gastro, I suppose?
You know, everybody in the room here potentially has been to an endoscopy unit, and you've been in the gastroenterologist will come in and do the scope, and then you've got the nurse there to assist with the procedure. But then after that, you need a link. So you, and like as Ciarán alluded to earlier on, you know, you go in, you have all these procedures done, then you're sent off to the greater wider world and you don't know where to go, what to do, what happened. You know, I think you've, you know, post-sedation, what's gone on, where has it been? So, you know, from our perspective, we are, or I am, the link between you and your healthcare professional team. So I'm part of the multidisciplinary team to include doctors, nurses, dietitians, psychotherapists, all of us. And then we work collectively, surgeons as well too. We work very close with surgeons. Collectively, just to make the best decision for you where you are. So you're at home, you're struggling, you don't know where to go, you came in, had a procedure, you saw a doctor, who do you talk to? So you ring someone like me, email, telephone service, and then we just sit down and talk. Initial diagnosis, I'll meet you as an inpatient or even post-endoscopy in the endoscopy room, which is difficult enough really because most procedures, you know, you've had sedation, you don't necessarily remember what's gone on. So it's good to have that link then to come back and have that discussion afterwards in a more controlled environment as opposed to being in clinic or even, you know, rushing. You know, so it's your advocate, your education and advice really would be the three mainstays.
Yeah, I think, and it's really important because the IBD nurse really is the person who's going to help us stay out of hospital and manage the condition at home as much as possible and keep us well. And the big thing, you know, I think those of us that live with IBD are like, oh, will I say this? I don't want to be a bother. It's nearly like an Irish thing as well, isn't it? And I'm like, no, bother. Because no. I remember Professor Subratagosh spoke last year at a Cork event and he had a great line that I've used so many times, which was, my favourite patient is a pushy patient. And I was like, that's really important to remember because we're always terrible to be like, sorry to bother, but you want to be bothered.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's what we're here for. We're here to keep you out of hospital. We're here to keep you well in whatever way, shape or form that is. Now, if we think we need to see you and bring you into hospital, that's the clinical decision we'll make at that time. It's all case dependent. But I suppose really, ideally, especially with trolleys and the way the health system is, unfortunately, that it's just we need to keep people out of A&E. And that's our, you know, and that's vital, I think, really more so than anything. And keep you fit, healthy, well. Maintain your life in whatever way, shape or form that is for you. You know, we need to get you healthy. We need to get you well. Get on with college. Get on with school. Get on with your life. Get on with work. Everything.
And that's why it's so important to, if you do see some symptoms starting to raise, immediately get in touch with your IBD clinic. Don't let them progress. Get them treated as soon as possible.
Early intervention is always vital, you know, so let's get in, let's get, you know, start in whatever way, shape or form, escalate treatment or whatever, you know, add in treatments. Like there's things we can do, you know, virtually now, because I mean, we all live in a virtual world now. Yeah. So there's a lot of things we can do virtually.
Thank you so much for that, Angela. Kieran, if I could go back to you, you're probably involved in Crohn's and Colitis Ireland, probably one of the longest serving current members of anyone probably at this stage, I would say. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of the charity. Could you maybe talk us through some of that?
Yeah, so, well, I haven't been around for 40. I was alive 40 years ago, but I wasn't around with then ISCC. But I understand that, so one of the very early board members was a lovely lady called Rona O'Brien, and she passed away just last month. So she kind of was our last link to the very early days of the organisation. But I understand it was just that, you know, that there were very few people in Ireland living with Crohn's and colitis. I think even on the very first set of minutes, we do have a record of the first few minutes back in 1984, and Crohn's was spelt incorrectly, which will just tell you how little we even knew about that. So it was in St. James's Hospital in Dublin, and there was a few healthcare professionals, and patients got together to provide some sort of support for people living with Crohn's and colitis, because there was really nothing at that time. And I suppose over the years, I could talk about maybe there have been two broad, for me, you know, befores and afters, there was the before and after the internet, and there was the before and after when we recruited, you know, employees, because prior to that it was just run by volunteers. So before the internet, the support services were really based on public meetings around the country. There was an annual open day in around April every year, and the wonderful Professor Shanahan, who Victoria was talking about earlier on, organised a day in around November every year, most years, I understand, and which was very, very well attended for people in Cork. And then they rotated public meetings around the country. So they might go to sort of Waterford every 2 or 3 years, or Tullamore every 2 or 3 years. So wherever there was a centre where there was a hospital with a gastroenterology team. So the focus then was really around sort of providing information, because there wasn't the internet and people didn't have access to information. Whereas since then, and now that we have the internet and social media, I think the focus has moved more towards the provision of support because that information is more freely available. And then there's the move from, you know, being wholly volunteer-led to being having staff day-to-day to run the operation and to deliver the support services. And since then, I think we've reached a situation where there's more stability and we can grow and add to support. And I know that Amy, you and Karen have lots, and I'm with the board, working with the board, have lots of exciting plans to sort of expand and grow that into the future. Because, you know, there are ways to manage living with Crohn's and colitis. You know, we can live a better life. Everything points to the fact that, and I know, Amy, you did a survey just recently, and all of these surveys and studies point to the fact that people do find that living with Crohn's and colitis, and like any other long-term health condition, does have impacts in your career, aspirations, educational, social, intimate relationships and things like that. But there are actually ways to deal with that. And just even bringing people together today and talking is really, really wonderful.
You're never alone on the journey. And I think that's the whole point of days like today, Crohn's and Colitis Ireland, from everybody who was involved with it over the years, that, you know, so many of us who got involved in the charity have IBD or probably know somebody who has IBD. And that's obviously what led to that. So you're speaking with people who just get it. And that's what I love about, you know, this podcast and obviously being here in the room in Cork, that like, you know, I'm sure the attendees here, but they were chatting away before we started the podcast recording. And, you know, I always find that you could just do a whole day on just the networking part and opportunity to chat, because for a lot of people, it's the first time you get to chat with somebody that you don't have to explain yourself to, that you can just be like, say something and then someone says, oh my God, yeah, me too. And you're like, oh my God, that's amazing. And it just helps because you just know that you're not alone. And that's the thing, we're here to support.
And can I just say that, you know, it's not about denying reality, okay? We know there are challenges of living with, we're not trying to say to people, you know, people say, oh, you know, I'm really impacted by my Crohn's disease. We're not trying to say, well, you're not impacted, because we know you are, but it's about dealing with that and teaching people how to problem solve and make difficult decisions. Like, for example, decision-making in life in general can be very difficult. If you add the additional layer of living with a condition like Crohn's or colitis, it just adds an additional layer of complexity, but it's just something you can actually deal with. And if I could just say one thing that has affected me over the years, and one reason I really wanted to get involved and help people, I suppose, is that I do remember a couple of times in my life, I've made decisions based on people saying to me, like I was maybe taking a particular course of action, a big decision maybe, you know, in relation to my career or education, and people sort of said things like, do you think that's a good idea? They'd screw up their face, do you know what I mean? Do you think that's a good idea? And they were very well-meaning, but you know, what in-depth detailed analysis went into them saying, do you think that's a good idea? Well, really nothing. So I would advise people to really, before making decisions, don't just take the advice off the cuff remark from somebody who may be very well-meaning, and they may be saying it in a very caring way, but spend some time focusing on the decision or the problem, speak to different people. Don't take, you know, the response from just one person. Nothing has not been done by somebody who's living with Crohn's or colitis.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important point, that I always say that as well. No matter what we want to do in life, we're going to get to do the things we want to do in life. But sometimes we might just have to go do a little pivot, and we might have to do it a slightly different way, depending. Most things you will still get to do in your life and, you know, have all those things, but certain times might need a slight pivot depending on our IBD. If I could just go to Victoria, just to bring Victoria in as well. Victoria, you got involved in CCI a few years ago as well. And just based on what Angela and Kieran have said, what was the reason you got involved?
So basically, I was someone who I always wanted to go into a career where I could help people. And when I was younger, I was saying I'd love to be a clinician or even a nurse. But then I was saying, okay, if I have this illness where I do have to be admitted to hospital a lot, if I go down this route, then I'd be possibly working in a hospital and being admitted, so I may as well just move into one. So I was like, okay, I have to think outside the box. And I think that's what a lot of people with Crohn's colitis can resonate with, is that, you know, and that's similar to what Ciarán said, like, you know, life doesn't go according to plan, and you do have to, you know, when you certain times in life where you do have to make decisions, it is okay, what is best for me at this particular time? So I went down the social science route where I could try and help people that way. And then when I got my ileostomy, I had to change things again, and was like, great, how else can I, what am I going to do with my life now? I felt like 4 years of college down the drain. So I did a master's in public health and epidemiology. I said I'll go into health research. And then 3 years ago, just over 3 years ago, I started work in APC Microbiome Ireland in University College Cork, where Fergus Shanahan was actually the founding director of the centre, and it focuses on gut health. I know some people in the room might be aware of the APC. And I started in April, and for their World IBD Day, which obviously everything was virtual at the time during COVID, I spoke on their webinar, and Ciarán was on that particular webinar as well. I reached out to him afterwards because I said I would love to get involved with Crohn's Colitis Ireland, just because it was supporting people, it was always close to my heart. And I think because I was so far down the path of my journey of living with Crohn's disease, that I said, okay, it would be working in the APC and getting involved in CCA, that, you know, we may be able to mesh together at times and stuff like that, and just be able to help people in whatever way possible, because I know that support is a big thing for people. And it's having Crohn's disease is, and ulcerative colitis, it's something that can be very lonely. And I think that it's, IBD is a disease where I say that we're all the same, but we're different at the same time. Even though I would have had an unbelievable support network from day one, and still do, there's still times where you can sit in your room and you can just feel very alone, because as much as your family can be there and try to understand, they still don't understand. They understand a different perspective. They understand that they've got a loved one who's suffering and that they can feel helpless at times. And I just think that I wanted to use my own experience to try and be an advocate for those who may not be strong enough to be able to speak up, you know, if they're too ill or whatnot, or, you know, some people they might just be afraid to as well. And it's like, I just wanted to become involved with CCI because of the work that we can actually just do to help to support others when it's needed, and it's needed.
Yeah, and I think it's brilliant to have you as part of the team, because, you know, Victoria got involved in even coordinating our support groups last year, and, you know, even through our helpline, you know, we often get calls with people who perhaps are going to have a surgery and or maybe might be getting a stoma, or have maybe just got a stoma, whatever it might be. And it's people like Victoria that we can connect, you know, anyone who calls, to speak with someone directly who's lived through that and ask the questions. And that's all about the support through CCI. And it's amazing. Victoria is just phenomenal. I could sit here and speak of her praises. Angela, can I bring you in as well? Because I suppose we spoke about the charity in existence for the past 40 years and, you know, with the changes, and obviously from both Ciarán and Victoria's story, you know, with the changes that they've seen over the years. Can I talk to you perhaps maybe of how you have found through your involvement since the 90s, you said it was 93, you know, how has, I suppose, the care of IBD changed and the, you know, treatment options and those things? Because that is a positive thing that we shouldn't kind of not take for granted, that, you know, there's a lot of ways for us to manage our condition now and live well and, you know, be well outside of hospital.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you talk on one front, like the medical treatment in itself, like, so in the 90s, unfortunately, all really that was available was first-line corticosteroids. And everybody in this room will know corticosteroids are anti-inflammatories. They're very, very good at what they do, but there's really, really bad side effects to taking long-term steroids. The medications then that were available to us in the 90s as well were quite limited. So we had two drugs that you had to go into hospital, get an IV infusion for one and continue then every couple of weeks to come back in for an hour. And the other one then was an injection that you took yourself at home. So two drugs available and that was it. And surgery was a big thing. We had to, unfortunately, at that time, a lot of people went down a surgical route. But sometimes it's the only option, as Victoria said, you know. So, but now I suppose it's exciting insofar as, you know, it's a lot more of a holistic approach. Medicine with all these new drugs are coming on board. So now we have access to about 10 biologics, which is great. A whole load of new generation type of medication. But as well as that, we have, you know, psychological support, dietitian support. You know, we have a multiple disciplinary team approach now, as opposed to just seeing the doctor, the nurse, and you going home, you know, which is great.
Yeah, there's more of an understanding that it's a whole person. It's not
it's a holistic approach now, as opposed to just the disease, you know, which I think is really, really important, because everybody wants you to live your best life in whatever way, shape or form that is. And I think that is the core of everything. You know, it has to be.
Yeah, it's amazing the research that has been done over the past number of years. And we, like, there's still so much unknown. Mm. I know obviously we live in it, but a part of it is nearly kind of fascinating, because it's such a complex condition that is so misunderstood, you know, and there's so much work that still needs to be done and understanding and all of it. But we have come so far. And the good thing for us to remember is that there is something else there for us. You know, there's always new stuff. There's more stuff coming down the line, which is great. And that's what we need to remember. I'm guilty of it myself. If I'm finding that something I'm on, you know, isn't working, and you start self-blaming or like, why isn't it? And whatever it might be. And it's nothing got to do with that. It's just important for us to remember that.
And it is important to note as well, too, that, you know, you try these medications and they're tried and tested, and the science will tell you what the science will tell you. But unfortunately, sometimes they just don't work, you know, and it's nothing you did, as you said, absolutely nothing, you know, but there are options. And it's very important to know that there are options out there now. And surgery, and in combination with surgery as well, too, sometimes it is just the only option.
You know. And it's an important option. Like, I think, like, naturally, anyone doesn't have to live with IBD. Anyone, when we hear surgery, of course, you know, we're going to be a little bit nervous. It's surgery at the end of the day, but it can be a really effective treatment option for people, you know, for, and as Victoria had mentioned, you know, like, it's ways people live really well as well, and just be that pathway that people have to go through. Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, you know, it's the nature of the beast, as I, you know, I refer to it all the time, the nature of the beast, because that's what it is. It goes away and it goes sleeping,
yeah,
or it goes to bed or whatever.
It's just like myself, snoring away.
Yeah, you know, and then it just comes back to bite you, and it's just, and that's what it is, and that's what it does, unfortunately, you know. Yeah. But it's about managing. But we have a lot of overlap anyway with all three other disciplines like rheumatology and dermatology. So there's a lot of overlap with all of us.
It's an important point to highlight because, you know, it can show in our skin, it can show in our eyes, it can show in our joints and variations. And that's why we keep going back to the point that we need to be ringing the IBD nurses, that if we're seeing, you know, something, sometimes we can put it down to our IBD or it might not be part of our IBD, but it's really important to flag things to our team to get them further investigated. And that's the point of your team. They're there to help you when you see that manifestation of anything outside of, you know, the gut. Yeah, Kieran, you would?
Yeah, Amy, just a second. That I think that's the one piece of advice that we would give people, is that if you feel that symptoms that you're experiencing are actually a flare, it's like, you don't have to wait until your next appointment. So your next scheduled appointment with outpatients may be 3 months out or 6 months out. So it's to con- and this is why the role of the IBD nurse and the fact that we have so many more IBD nurses and wonderful people like Angela in the country, is to reach out to those, like, literally, I would say, like, the millisecond you feel this is actually a flare, don't just try to be brave. The IBD nurses want to hear from you, and they want to hear from you earlier. I think you used the word earlier intervention then.
Yeah, it's a really important point, actually. Victoria, if I could bring you in, I know you said that you were diagnosed quite well, and I'd really just love to get your insight on, I suppose, anyone that listens in. We get calls, obviously, from people who perhaps might be in secondary school or managing that kind of aspect. Is there any advice that you would give kind of child or adolescents, and perhaps even parents, because naturally it's parents ringing in to the helpline. But is there anything, I suppose, from that perspective that you'd like to let people know about?
I think the first thing that I would always say is something that my parents actually said to me upon my diagnosis: you have to fight harder than others to have a normal life. And that always stuck with me. I personally would be a very competitive person. I got into competition in my own head with my own body. I just never wanted to leave this win. Now, look, I did have to fight to get to finish secondary school, to get into college, to even when I started in the world of work. And my life has been a complete roller coaster because, it hasn't gone according to plan. So again, as I said earlier, I've always had to think outside the box to what the next stage of my career might be, or what, how I can, say, live the next month. You know, plans can be scuppered. Again, today I should have been there, and it was a case of working with Amy, how can we make this happen? That's just the realities of it. But I would just say that you can have a normal life. It mightn't be normal to what, you know, when you're 5 or 6 years of age, where it's like, I want to grow up and be an astronaut. You may not be that astronaut, but you can. That doesn't mean that you can't work in that particular area. You know, it is to not be afraid, and don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't think that you're actually pestering your gastro team, as Sabrata said last year. I have always lived by this. I think there was times where I'd say that my mother felt like she was going to be just escorted out of CUH because she would just pester and pester and pester when I was younger on my behalf. Hence how I'm now like that. Just keep asking, even if it's like, but why, but why, but why. The more ask your questions, and the more that you know, and the more knowledgeable that you can get, the the more control that you feel that you can have over disease, that makes you feel that you're out of, that your body's out of control a bit, because it is something that we can't control in a way. We can't control getting into a flare as such, because it is such a complex disease. You know, you can control elements with medication and diet and exercise, etc. But there are other times you could be following the rule book with IBD to the dot, and you can still get into a flare. You know, so it's just one of those things where, unfortunately, our bodies, we can't control them the way that we'd like to. So it is that case of going to your appointments with your questions. Even if you leave, ring the IBD nurses afterwards. If you think of something else and said, "Oh, okay, I didn't think of this," or I email, drop them an email, and just be ready for your life to not go according to plan. But I always say everything happens for a reason. The way that I look at Crohn's is that it's put me on a path that I would never have imagined for myself. But I'm here, and outside of recovery and having to have surgery, I'm very happy in my life, you know. And it's a case of, even with there's things that aren't even spoken about, you know, as you get older, getting into relationships and having to deal when you are younger and a teenager in particular, and I think females in particular, when you are on a high dose of steroids, when your appearance does change, there's a lot to contend with. And you do, I remember there was comments thrown at me walking down the street. "Oh God, what's after happening to her? Look," and there was one comment I'll always remember, and like, "Gosh, you're after getting colossal fat." And I was like, "Well, I'm on a very high dose of steroids. I was only 16. And I was like, "Oh, okay." But those comments stuck in my head all these years later. And I'm a very tough, resilient person, but those comments were still in my head. And even now, I'm a person where, even when I got gynae and I was going on my first summer holiday, and I was like, "Oh, what swimmer are you going to wear now? Surely, like, you'll have to get something to cover up." And I said, "I'm going to wear a bikini. Gynae is part of me. Why am I going to change the swimmer that I'd always wear?" And I've just recently had that question again, saying, "You've had more surgery in your stomach. What are you going to wear going on holidays this summer?" It's like, "I'll wear what I want to wear, and I'm comfortable in a bikini." And I've had comments on holidays, "What's that on your side?" You know, those things. It's those things that people would be afraid. Where it's like, if you're comfortable, you will live the way that you want to live your life once you're comfortable.
It all ties into the invisible nature of this condition, and the fact that it's so often misunderstood as well. And I think, you know, anyone that might be listening into the podcast, or perhaps even in the room today, friends, family, colleagues, whoever it might be, just having the compassion and understanding is something that we are always advocating when we do anything in regards to media, that, you know, it's an invisible illness, and it's just simply, you don't have to know everything about the illness. You just need to know and support that person there and then, and just be conscious of questions that are asked. Thank you, Victoria, for sharing that. Andrea, can I just ask as well, because I know you've been a big supporter of CCI over the years, can you let me know, even just from clinic point of view, the importance of people linking in with, you know, support groups, and do you see that impact? And
oh, 100%. So look, this is a disease that nobody wants to talk about. It's poo, right? At the end of the day, you've got bloody diarrhea, you've got pain, you're running to the toilet, you can't leave the house, you know, it's embarrassing, yeah. Right? I think everybody in the room probably knows this already. So I think to have that advocate group for you, to like-minded people who are exactly in the same situation. So I think, well, I know that in our practice, we actually give everybody booklets. You know, this is a group that you need to engage with. I think it's very important because, you know, like Ciarán said, it's important to have like-minded people with you so you can turn around to them and say, "Oi, I had this today." And you said, "Oh yeah, I had that, yeah," or whatever. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I think that's very important, vital, because it's not just the disease, it's the whole person, you know. So that's the most important. And to know that you have that group out there. Yeah. Crohn's and Colitis Ireland, I mean, in fairness, has grown in leaps and bounds, even since I was part of the board. I mean, it's absolutely escalated, which is wonderful, but so has Crohn's and colitis.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is very important that we highlight this and have that patient advocate group, or have somebody at the end of the telephone line, you know, ringing the helpline as well too, I think is so important as well too,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, I think on that, we're very tight for time. I have the same question to end with to all three of you, just, I suppose, it kind of leads quite well onto that. You know, when we think about the next 40 years for the IBD community, can you think of maybe one or two things that you would hope would change for the better?
Well, your question asks about the next 40 years.
Yeah,
I'd like it for the next five years.
We'll start
years,
the podcast the
next,
again, will we?
For the next 6 months, for the next week, I'd like so. I think briefly, just First of all, I mean, other disease groups in the HSC have a clinical care program, and I think that it would support both health care professionals and the patients if there was a more structured sort of clinical care program. I know there's being worked on in this space, but linking in, as was mentioned earlier on, Angela said, the holistic approach. So I think that would work better if it was part of more of a structure. I mean, I had great access to dietitians very much in the early days who were fantastic. I saw them on my bedside every day. And yet 34 years later, we're still hearing that people aren't seeing dietitians routinely. Second thing is CCI funding. And I think that, as I said earlier on, that the medical part, we've got access to much more expensive drugs and therapies, which is fantastic. We are a wealthy country, so we should have. But we also need more funding to go towards the living well outside. So funding CCI and the support service that we want to grow and that you want to grow. I know you want to grow as well.
Thank you, Ciarán. Angela?
Yeah, I think, you hit the nail on the head there, Ciarán. We're not part of the chronic disease. It's not an automatic medical card application, and I think that's very important. I think that's actually vital because you have a lot of people who are sick that can't go to work, even though we'd advocate people to continue working. You know, sometimes it's just not feasible, right? So I think that's very important. So financial, I think just continue to advocate as much as we can. Local elections, general elections, like there's lots of things going on. Now, in fairness, we have doubled up I was involved in the CCI double up campaign for more IBD nurses. And there is a national clinical program for IBD, which is wonderful, or gastroenterology and hepatology both. But I think we just need to keep
the pressure on.
Yeah,
keep the pressure on and keep being loud and advocating. And you're right, like access to the long-term illness scheme, access to the difference that would make to people. And that's something that we're always advocating for. So, yeah, we'll keep the pressure on. Absolutely. Yeah. Victoria, could I bring the same question to you?
Yeah, probably just echo what Ciarán and Angela said. IBD actually being recognised as a long-term illness because it absolutely is not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere. Anyone who has it, we have it for life. And I think just to continue strengthening the holistic approach across all hospitals, really, access to dietitians, psychologists, all that. It's because I think that the well-being side of it, yes, the medical side can be very well looked after by the IBD nurses and the clinicians, surgeons, stoma nurses, all that. But I think just to increase the access to the psychological element of it is vital, especially I think for younger people in particular, being diagnosed young in particular, well, any age, with a long-term illness as tough as IBD is very daunting, can consume your life in ways. So I do think that psychological access should be absolutely increased.
Thank you so much, Victoria. And I'd like to thank all three of you for being with us today and providing your insight. It was a really interesting conversation. I hope those of you in the room got a lot out of it. I know I even did. And I hope those that are listening, obviously, to the episode of the podcast as well, really enjoyed it and got a lot from it as well. Thank you for being with us here in the Kingsley Hotel as we celebrated World IBD Day and the 40th anniversary of the charity. Thank you to Victoria. Thank you to Ciarán. And thank you to Angela. Can we get a round of applause for them?
The views, information, or opinions expressed during the GutCast podcast series are solely those of the individuals involved and do not represent those of Crohn's and Colitis Ireland or Johnson & Johnson. Payment was made to CCI for its employees' and board members' time recording the podcast. Payment was made directly to other contributors for their time recording the podcast. The primary purpose of this podcast series is to educate and inform and is not a substitute for professional diagnosis or treatment. This podcast is funded by Johnson & Johnson.